Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. And today my guest is someone that if you watch Live PD, you're very familiar with. Officer Andrea Zendejas from El Paso Police Department. We follow you every week on the show, and you've got quite a following, I must say. Welcome to PD Stories.
Thank you.
Let's start at the very beginning. Tell me where you're from, originally.
I'm originally from Bristol, Virginia.
Not Texas.
Not Texas.
But you seem like a perfectly at home Texan on the streets of El Paso.
I am at home there, but that's my home for now.
Now, before you became a police officer, I understand you were in the military.
I was.
And tell me about your service.
I did almost 10 years in the Army, active duty. I lived many places. I lived in upstate New York, California, and then my last stop was Fort Bliss, Texas, in El Paso. So that's where I ended up almost 10 years later.
What made you go into law enforcement?
I always wanted to be a police officer. I had a very influential role model in my life, my uncle. He was a police officer. Kind of showed me like what I wanted to be, like the type of person I wanted to be. Very caring, very giving, even still to this day. I just wanted to be like him.
What's the most interesting thing you remember from your military career?
The most interesting thing that I can recall from being in the military, this is a little crazy, but I was stationed at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California for about 3 years. Our main mission there was to train the soldiers that were deploying. We were there to train them up on, you know, real life scenarios. I mean, it's the extent of the training was extravagant. Like they would get, you know, amputees to come and play as, you know, blown up soldiers and stuff. It's really amazing. The training is the most realistic you can get anywhere in the world. So we would have to go to the field and live for weeks at a time until the unit left, you know, and then we were able to go home. The field is in the middle of the Mojave Desert. So we're about 35 minutes from the post out in the desert where they built these makeshift Iraqi towns, Afghani towns. And we go out there and we had a specific mission. We pretty much played the bad guys. So we would work in like teams of two, and I was with my soldier. I was a non-commissioned officer. I was a sergeant, and I had a soldier under me. And I refer to him as my hero. Mm-hmm. we had went out one night, and we had generators, so we had some electricity and stuff, so we were able to, you know, watch movies or have a fan or something because it's very hot. Mm-hmm. So I had walked to my vehicle to grab my laptop for the night so I could watch a movie. I heard a hiss, sounded like a cat. And the next thing I knew, I had a rattlesnake hanging off my foot. So it didn't let go. It was like that. It was less than probably a foot long. So the next thing I knew, I was like, oh, my gosh, I started freaking out. I was like, I got to get him out here so he can, you know, get me to the hospital, because that's been like one of my worst fears ever. Snakes are my worst fear.
And you got bit by a rattlesnake.
I sure did. And so he came out. He heard me yell for him. He came out, and I actually was able to shake it off my foot. Mm-hmm. And here I'm panicking, and he's like, he's this, you know, big country boy. So he came out. He actually stomped it, mm-hmm. Was able to put it into a box. Mm-hmm. And he was
like, to bring it to the doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
He was like, get in, we gotta go. And I'm like, oh, holy crap, we're like 35 minutes from the Army hospital. And right then, of course, you have an adrenaline dump, like right off the bat. And the main thing with that is I knew I had to keep myself calm. He took me to, we call it the white cell, where everything's ran. We had a landing zone where they tried to set up a landing zone with chem lights.
To evacuate?
Right. Uh-huh. After a little while, because it was like a dust storm, they couldn't find the landing zone. So once they did, I got to the hospital in about 35 minutes, 40 minutes. And at that time, I couldn't even open my eyes. I was having violent, like, muscle spasms. They got me in, got me on a bunch of medication, stabilized me. And from there, I was flown to a snake bite unit in Southern California for about a week.
Wow. Wow. That is quite an experience.
It was pretty intense, pretty crazy.
Did you have any after effects months or weeks afterwards?
Initially after, I've had broken ankles. You mm-hmm. know, we do a lot of like ruck marches, mm-hmm. like yeah. in the mountains and stuff. I've had 3 broken ankles. So that snake bite, because it kind of like eats the tissue, mm-hmm.
Kills tissue, right?
Right. It was way more painful than any broken bone I've ever had mm-hmm. for about, I don't know, 3 weeks. And then after that, I just had like nerve damage to my foot. That's pretty much it.
But you made a full recovery?
I did.
Wow. And when did you actually apply and go into the academy in El Paso?
I got out of the military in 2012, the end of 2012. I actually had my son in 2013. And right after I had my son, I applied to the police academy. Once I applied, I was picked up. I prepared myself, and I completed the academy. I actually completed 2 academies, one at a community college level, and then I went to the El Paso Police Department Academy.
Now, did your prior service and going through boot camp in the military and 10 years in the service help you make it easier for you to get through the academies?
I think it did. I think I have more skills to cope with maybe the stressors that they may overwhelm some other people. The military teaches you a lot of skills, coping mechanisms.
And build your confidence.
For sure.
The firearms training for you, was that something you acclimated to easily?
I had no problems with the firearms training. I like to shoot. I had multiple weapons, shotguns, you know, rifles. So it's kind of like already had the fundamentals down. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that hard for me. And still to this day, I enjoy going to the range, and it's been real good. And I can't say I really had much of an issue with that.
And what was the thing that you remember the most about the academy being the most challenging part of it?
The most challenging part of the academy for me was being tased.
Ah, tell us about what it's like to be tased, Andrea Zendejas.
I've been tased twice because I had to be.
And explain to our audience why a police officer has to be tased as a part of the academy training.
So we have to be tased. That way we know how it feels. So when we actually have to deploy our taser on a subject, we can testify to the fact that, well, we know how that feels.
Interesting. I know when I went through special police officer training in D.C., we did not carry tasers, but we carried pepper spray. So we had to be pepper sprayed in the eyes, and that was a miserable experience, too. I mean, you've been pepper sprayed?
I have. I'll take that every day, all day.
Over
getting tased.
They're both miserable experiences, I'm sure, but you get through it and you get on out in the streets, and when you have to deploy it, you deploy it.
For sure.
When you start your shift, and you've been working night shift for how long now?
3.5 years.
3.5 years. It's a definite lifestyle change. I liked it in some ways for some reasons, and then in terms of how it affects your health, it does change your lifestyle. Do you like working the night shift? And how did you adjust to it?
I am a night owl, so I don't mind it as much. I prefer the nighttime to the day. I do know that it did take me a little bit time to adjust, especially starting out right out of the academy. Coming out of the academy, I have a whole year of probation. So every 4 months, we would rotate to each shift. And of course, I ended up on graveyards because...
You're a rookie.
Because I'm a rookie. So I just so happened to love it. And I love the adrenaline, and just stayed. As far as health-wise, it does take a toll on your health, for sure. One, we have to bring our own food unless you want to eat, you know, fast food all the time, which is awful. And the levels of stress. I mean, any police officer should be on high alert at all times, but we're on extra.
The freaks come out at night. That's the
we're
bottom
on line. Extra high alert over there. Yeah. So.
And you're a parent. You said you have a son, right?
I have a son and a daughter.
Son and mm-hmm. a daughter.
Yes.
How do you balance that, working at night with, and being a mom?
I have to place a lot of trust in people. I have no family there. Their father is in El Paso. So we usually try to work out our schedules to where our days don't overlap. And either I have the kids or he has the kids and just hope it works.
During your rookie year, did anything totally unexpected happen to you that you just weren't really prepared for in the academy?
I did. Actually, like my second week on, I wasn't ready at all. I don't think anybody is at that point. But I was with my FTO, and we conducted a traffic.
That's a field training officer.
Yes, my field training officer. And we conducted a traffic stop on this vehicle. And from the start, the guy was very nervous. or he didn't have, you know, any kind of identification. So we asked him to come out of the car. He gave consent to search the vehicle. And my field training officer was like, hey, keep an eye on this guy. Keep an eye on him. And I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm watching him. No, nothing's going to happen. Well, my field training officer actually looked at me and, you know, did the this, which means, you know, like cross his arms, which means go ahead and put handcuffs on him.
Uh-huh. So you gave the cross wrists. Symbol.
Right, okay. Right, right.
Like an X almost. Okay.
Yeah, like an X. So I was like, oh, okay. This is my first time. So I was all excited. And as soon as I grabbed the guy's wrist, he took off. He was gone.
And did you chase him?
We chased him, but he actually, we lost sight of him, and it come to find out he crawled through a doggy door on a house.
How big was this guy?
He was a tall, skinny guy. So
if he went through a doggy door.
Did. He absolutely did. And just so happens we found his ID, and we were able to work up the warrant, and well, he's in jail now. So for a long time, because he had other charges as well.
Wow. You know, that's a learning experience right
it
there.
It sure is.
If you have a doggy door in your house, there may be some criminally minded person small enough to get through that doggy door.
Put a lock on it.
Put a lock on it. I've heard of people actually sending their child in through a doggy door to break into someone's house. Actually, this is true. People have used their children to sneak through a doggy door into a house and unlock the door. There are some people who have actually taught their kids to do that to further their criminal burglary ambitions.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. But you know, I don't underestimate anybody in this society. Do you?
Nope.
You can't. You
absolutely
really
not.
Can't. There are people that we see on Live PD that you look at them when they first roll up on them, you're like, oh, this person's not guilty. Why are the police messing with them? And then you see that the officer's instinct was way ahead of me in the audience sitting there watching. Now, the audience, now we thought one thing. Next thing you know,
It's that spidey sense, as we call it.
Mm-hmm. You just build on that as your years of being an officer. You just build on that knowledge, that experience, that gut instinct. I've always found that your initial thought or instinct is usually the correct one.
It is.
It usually
sure.
is.
And I totally agree with that. Every time that you feel like something's wrong, usually is. Mm-hmm. It's so crazy. Like you get these feelings and you're like, you know, when you're like your gut, you're like, oh God, something's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And we use that a lot. It's crazy.
Now, what part of El Paso are you patrolling when we see you on Live PD? Where are you in the city?
Okay. So El Paso's, separated into five different regional commands. And I work in the Northeast Regional Command. Some people think that maybe that region's a little worse than any of the others there, but I'm sure they all have their
pockets.
You know, yeah, for sure. We do see a lot of the more violent crimes that happen there, the shootings, the stabbings, the gang-related activity, stuff like that. So maybe we are a little bit more on high alert than maybe some of the other areas, but that's the Northeast.
You seem to have a real gift for just talking to people on the street and assessing the situation, keeping them calm and in a even when they're highly agitated, we watch you on Live PD talk to people and ratchet down the tension. And that's a gift that not everyone has. Not all police officers have that even. It's something that's unique to the individual.
Well, in the military, I was injured and I had a spinal surgery. With that, I knew that I can't be acting all crazy all the time and, you know, and go hands-on and, you know, just get people to do what I want physically, you know, I muscle my way out of it or whatever. So once that happened, I was kind of like more in tune with trying to talk to people. And it's actually, it's helped me so much. And I'm able to de-escalate a lot of situations just by talking to people. And I know a lot of people over there. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the people we run into, they know me as well. Also, this time last year, I also had to have an additional spinal surgery. I had a fusion. So it's important for me. I can't get injured, mm-hmm. you know. And if that means that I have to talk to this person, whether they're crazy, whether they're irate, whatever the case may be, to save myself, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes the mind is more powerful than having to put your hands on somebody all the time.
When we see you on Live PD out there patrolling, a lot of times you're in your car and people flag you down. And we see all these wild encounters that you have, like most recently with a woman who claimed to be Snoop Dogg's, we calculated, fourth cousin based on how she described the genealogy of this thing. Brenda, you run into people like Brenda, right? And you knew her. You'd met her before, right?
I'm very familiar with Brenda.
Tell me about Brenda.
Well, Brenda, she's been around since I've been working in the Northeast. I usually try to check on her a little bit to make sure she's okay, to make sure she ate or she's drinking water or something, because it gets real hot out there and sometimes, you know, people don't take care of themselves. And Brenda, she's a character.
But I believe she is really Snoop Dogg's cousin, too.
I believe she is, too.
I believe
that. He never reached out, so I'm sure he didn't. To confirm that.
I'm sure he didn't. But let's talk about the city of El Paso, shall we? El Paso is a border town, and it's a unique border town. It's almost a million people, 900,000, I think. Across the river, you have one of the most rough and tumble cities in all of Mexico.
Yes.
Juarez, right?
Yes.
Tell us about the environment down there on the border with your city and the things that cross back and forth across in terms of policing and criminal behavior.
We do have a lot of issues. I'm not actually right on the border, so that's
because you're Northeast District,
right? That's mm-hmm. more of a like a central area. But we do still see some of it. We do have a lot of people passing through that commit high crimes, try to make it across the border before they're caught. Sometimes we intercept those people, especially if they're coming through New Mexico, because they come right through our area. We kind of already know who we're looking for anyway. A lot of times people will get shot over in Juarez and they'll bring them across the border for medical treatment. We see a lot of that. There's also a lot of drug trafficking. I just seen an 82-year-old lady at our county jail a couple weeks ago who
trafficking?
Who had crossed like 8 or 9 pounds of heroin.
82 years old.
You know, wow. You feel bad for her. I'm like, what did she do? You know, and then you find out, wow, she crossed like a lot of drugs. But I think that comes with any kind of border town. And we're going to get a lot of this stuff from Mexico. It's a lot of drugs that come across.
What does the justice system do with an 82-year-old woman who's been caught trafficking large amounts of narcotics? I mean, what does the system do to somebody that's 82?
From the looks of it, she was going to jail, and I don't know if she'll sit there and wait. I'm not really sure what the judge
would decide.
It's just
a unique situation, right?
It's very unique, and I guess they think, well, nobody's going to mess with this mm-hmm. this little lady, you know, but unfortunately, she did get caught up by the federal government.
I knew a guy in D.C. that was a heroin dealer going all the way back to the 60s, and he got caught the last time at 76 years old, you know, and he just
and a lot of these people, unfortunately, they'll die in prison.
What are some of the scariest things that you've experienced as a police officer?
The scariest things, I believe, to me, there's a couple. One being responding to an unresponsive child. That's one of the worst things I've ever had to go through. One, I'm a parent. You know, I have a small child. And you don't know if you're going to be able to save them or not. It's that's something hard for me to process. And it's happened a few times. And it's worked out some, and then others it hasn't. So that's something, you know, we have to live with. But another is hearing my partners on the radio or knowing when something's going down and you have to just get there because you don't know if their lives, well, of course our lives are on the line, but you don't know exactly what's going on, but you hear their voice and you know that something's wrong, and or they're screaming on the radio for help. And you just try to get there as fast as you can. Other things, of course, the unknown. You never know when somebody has a weapon. I've taken plenty of weapons off the streets in the last year. You don't know what people's intents are. And I have a family to go home to, so that I think that scares me the most.
Of all the crimes people commit that you encounter, what crime infuriates you the most and makes you the most satisfied when you can make an arrest on it?
That would be anything to do with children. I'm a huge advocate for kids. I was actually a court appointed special advocate for children, abused and neglected children.
CASA, through CASA?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've worked with CASA also.
Yeah. So, and you know, kids have always been like my, you know, my main priority anyway. I've seen some real sad things over the years. So that's what's in my heart. You know, anytime that there's kids involved, whether it be they're watching their parents fight or they're actually being abused, you know, whether it be, you know, physically or sexually or emotionally, whatever. I take those, I think, more personal. And I like to see the outcome of those cases to know for a fact that those people are taken care of.
Because, you know, it's just a fact of life. Children cannot choose their parents.
No, they cannot.
They can't choose their guardians. And I'm so happy that on LIPD, A&E allows us to profile missing children. Working with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, we've been able to recover some with the help of our viewers from LIPD. And it's just, to me, that's God's work. And
it is.
To do it through the medium of television like we did on America's Most Wanted for 25 years is just something that I'm so happy to be able to give to these children, to give them a chance to be found, to
right.
be reunited with the people that really love and care about them. And it's just the best feeling ever when we find out one's been recovered.
It is. And you know, what I've learned doing this job, you can arrest the drug addicts, you can arrest the people who beat on people, but the children, they have a chance to grow and be put in the right mindset if they have the right type of guidance. And I take that to heart. I take that to heart, and I focus a lot of my time on children, you know. It's something that's real important to me. If maybe they're just shown a little bit of kindness or a little bit of, you know, compassion, that not everyone is bad. Mm-hmm. It's so worth it to me. And that's honestly what makes me strive to do a good job. The children that you know need somebody to look up to.
Some guys that I worked with that came straight out of the military, been in Iraq, Afghanistan, they're 22, 23, they've been in combat, they're ripped and buffed, they spend half their time in the gym, and they hit the streets of America strapped up, badged up, and ready to go out there and just, you know, lay it down. And I would be like, yo, man, this is not a sprint here. This is a marathon, and this is not the Taliban, and you have to really deal with people on a whole different mentality than when you're overseas in the military dealing with the enemy.
For sure.
Because that's one of the things that one of the worst mindsets a police officer can fall into is viewing the public as the enemy.
I agree with that. And, you know, that comes with maturity, that comes with life experience, that comes with just developing yourself. Like you said, you know, you have these guys that are 22, 23, and I still see that. Mm-hmm. I see that every single day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, things get out of hand. when they shouldn't, or somebody should shut their mouth when they should. It's all about maturity and growing as a person, I believe. Figuring out, like, other ways to take care of situations instead of, you know, just always going straight to the physical.
Mm-hmm. Worst fight you've ever been in?
I've been in a couple scuffles, but they didn't last too long.
Yeah. Does that mean that you put it down pretty quick?
I put it down pretty quick, yeah. Yeah, I try to shut that out, like, immediately. I'm pretty fortunate with my partners. My partners, they're there within a, you know, a minute or two until they get there. I'm pretty able to hold my own. Pretty good at that.
Do you find that dealing with women suspects, have some of your most difficult encounters been with other women?
Yes. Women don't like other women. That's just the bottom line.
And why is that?
I don't know. I've never been like that. I give, like I said, I treat everybody pretty fair, I believe. But sometimes other women don't like other women telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. And then you have problems. And then they want to fight. And then you have to fight another woman. And then there we are. She's spitting. And, oh, women get bad. Women are, like, the worst. They'll spit on you. They'll kick you. They'll bite you. Oh, it's bad.
When someone is verbally giving you the business and they're just cursing you out and, you know, you're trying to deal with whatever the situation is, maybe there's no imminent crime having been committed. Can you explain the fine line there?
I try to approach every situation as well as I can. I give people the benefit of the doubt. If they don't like me, if they want to cuss me out, that's on them. It doesn't bother me. As long as they're not committing some kind of offense that, you know, they can go to jail for. It doesn't matter to mm-hmm. me. That comes with a mutual respect, I believe, though. And a lot of people don't have that anymore.
Mm-hmm. True.
We try to practice it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I do a pretty decent job. I give people the benefit of the doubt most of the time, unless I know them. Mm-hmm. That comes with, you know, just the mutual respect, but just being a human being. If somebody deserves to go to jail, well, you know what? They're going to go to jail, whether they want to or not. The fine line, it's maturity. What can you take? Mm-hmm. Can you take people yelling at you? Can you take people screaming at you? If you can, it's usually good, and you can keep it to the lowest level. But if not, then you might, you know, you might end up going to jail.
I think that a lot of people don't understand that the subject that the officer is dealing with dictates most of the time escalation or de-escalation. It's the behavior of the person you're dealing with that most of the time determines whether this is going to another level that will end up in some physical altercation with the officer or going to jail because they escalated the situation or getting tased or even, God forbid, use of deadly force on a person.
That's absolutely true. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, but a lot of the people we deal with, they do dictate what happens to them, you know, and that's on them if they decide to throw hands or they decide to run or whatever.
Or spit on you.
Or spit. That's on them. And if they decide to do that, then yeah, we're not going to stand by and just be spit on.
It only happened to me once, and I wasn't an officer when it happened. I was just a regular person. Somebody spit on me, and I hit him faster than I could even think about it. It just is a primal thing. Like, I can't believe you just spit in my face. You know,
I think that's the ultimate level of disrespect.
It is. It is.
For sure.
Yeah. Are you a crime junkie and want to understand more about the criminal mind and the science behind crime sleuthing? Check out A&E's Real Crime blog at aetv.com/realcrime. A&E's Real Crime blog has in-depth coverage from criminal psychologists, forensic scientists, crime scene investigators, law enforcement officers, and more. If you're passionate about crime, spend some time on aetv.com/realcrime. Officer Zendejas, how has being on Live PD changed your life?
It's actually changed a lot. I had certain plans within my department, which I had to change. As far as, like, I was interested in undercover work.
That's kind of out the window.
That's kind of out the window. That's kind of gone. So just being anywhere in El Paso, it's almost a daily occurrence.
People know you.
People recognize me, even when I'm not in uniform. That's kind of, it's really odd because I don't realize that so many people watch Live PD because I'm just used to being with my crew and then, you know, and that's all I'm used to.
Mm-hmm, right.
So when I'm out and about, I do see people and people know me. People want selfies and it's a little crazy. It's a little, I'm just a cop. Why do you want a picture with me? And it's changed. It's changed a lot. My family as well. My family's huge fans. And they're always watching, and they're always wanting to know what I'm doing, and you know, with the show and stuff. And so it is my lifestyle has changed a lot. I'm more cautious when I go. Well, I'm always cautious, but I'm even more cautious now, just in case.
What do you think Live PD brings to the American public about policing, and adds to the conversation about policing at this particular time in our history?
I think that Live PD has really brought to light what we actually go through on a daily basis. We're not all bad. We're not all out there to kick someone's, you know, to
ass.
Oh, ass. we're not out there to do that. You know, I know there's bad cops everywhere, but the majority, especially my guys, we commit ourselves, you know, to helping our mm-hmm. community.
Mm-hmm.
And
and you take the risk to do it every
single
shift.
We sure do. And it's one of those things when you come back in and you know that you made it for the night and you're going home to your family, it's like being rewarded kinda. But I think it's really important that that the people in America see exactly the things we go through. And from start pretty much to finish, you know, why things happen, why we do and react the way we do. I think it's very important, very important. And it's been a very positive experience. And I'm actually really thankful. I'm really thankful that I was able to bring to light the things that we actually face on a day-to-day basis. It means a lot to me because we're hated. We're hated a lot. You know, we receive death threats. We put up with a lot of stuff. People try to attack us. People try to, I've almost been stabbed. I've been shot at several times.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't know. It's just one of those things that I'm super thankful that I was able to bring to light, you know, what we actually face out there. And, you know, I speak for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it is in other communities, but it's been really good, you know, letting people know exactly what goes on without really having any kind of filter.
Yeah. I like the fact that Live PD to me is really like a tutorial for the public, and it shows people ways that they can avoid going to jail too. Okay, there are so many ways that you can avoid going to jail. If you watch Live PD, you should learn a couple of basic things. One, check all the lights on your car at least once a week before you go driving at night.
Especially if you're a drug dealer or a criminal.
Especially if you're a drug dealer. I love the ones like in Utah. We had a guy, he had a van, he's driving through Utah. Highway Patrol is excellent at drug interdiction out there. He's got a van, a minivan, family-looking van, but illegal tint. Now, the cartel has put hidden compartments in this van. I mean, they've gone to elaborate details to hide 30 pounds of weed in this van. But they put illegal tint on it, which gets them pulled over, which gets them found out and sent away with 30 pounds of weed intent to distribute, right?
They take care of themselves.
So I look at Live PD as a way, you know, to people, look, here's how you don't go to jail. One, don't drive with no license, okay? Two, make sure everything works on your car. This is just the easy ones, you know? Three, obviously, do not ingest drugs or drink alcohol before operating a motor vehicle.
True.
Simple.
True. Just don't do it.
And now we have Uber, we have Lyft, we have a million ways you can get from the bar to the club to your crib without endangering the public or yourself. So these are all things that we try to educate the public on Live PD, and I chime in on there and try to add my little color commentary on these things, and don't ride dirty, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, Live PD is really doing a great service to the public to help them understand, here's ways that I can avoid ever being in that situation.
Right.
Do this, don't do that.
Right, for sure.
Everybody on Twitter is always talking about your bun. Your bun's got its own hashtags. You've got all these different names, Queen Z. And you've even got, I love this. You have a fan who walks on two legs like a human, but is actually a...
kangaroo.
A kangaroo. Officer Zendejas has a kangaroo named Irwin, who is a devoted Live PD watcher.
He sure is.
Tell us about Irwin. It's just the best story.
So before Live PD, I never had a Twitter account. I was always just on Facebook and that's it. I don't do a lot of social media. But after Live PD started, I got the Twitter account and I started having I had this follower who would post these pictures and I'm like, oh, that is weird. Like, that's a kangaroo in a tuxedo. So it sparked my interest. So, you know, I started talking to the person and found out, I guess he was rescued. He's an avid Live PD fan. And I guess he responds to my voice. Uh-huh. So
there's pictures of Irwin sitting there watching Live PD and he's got on a t-shirt that says, I love Zendejas.
Yes. It's the greatest thing ever.
It is. It really, truly is. We've seen dogs that watch Live PD. There's a commercial with a dog howling at Live PD on the screen, but a kangaroo. How many years do you plan to be a police officer? Do you have a plan for, I'm going to do 20 and out or 25 and out? And what's your retirement setup in El Paso PD? What's it based on?
I believe I'll probably do 20. I'm going to try to do 20. Mm-hmm. If my health and my mind will allow it. We can retire at 20 years with El Paso. So that's my goal. I still have quite a journey to go, but that's my plan.
What would you do after police work? What would you want to do?
I have this planned out already.
You do?
So I do. Well, I'm going to move to the mountains in Tennessee and buy or build a log cabin away from people. And that's where I'll be.
You can start a floss farm and grow dental floss on a mountaintop. That's actually a line from Frank Zappa, one of Frank Zappa's songs. I'm going to move to Montana. But that's your plan, though. You want to move to the mountains?
That's my plan.
And do what up there?
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
We were talking, where you're from is like Bristol, Virginia, which is on the border of Tennessee.
Yes.
That's where the big Bristol NASCAR track is.
Yes.
And then south of there, a couple hours, is Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg, Dollywood. And it's just, if Americans don't know, listening to PD stories, that part of Tennessee is like, it's
beautiful.
Dixie Las Vegas. The first time I went down there and actually saw the smoke, the hazy fog, the blue, what they call the Great Smoky Mountains are called that because in the morning, the fog is actually blue. And the first time I saw it, that's when it all came clear to me why they call this the Smoky Mountains. I didn't really know until I saw it with my own eyes. But you want to live on one of those mountains, huh?
I do.
Well, this has been a great conversation with you. Thank you for being here with us in New York. I'm just so glad you were able to come. You were able to come and be on Live PD. And be safe out there in the streets of El Paso. We'll be praying for you as always. And continue to do the great work you've been doing.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.